Throughout all of history, they've only talked about the fame, never the hard work, never the elbow grease, never the early call time.
Good morning, early call timers. It's Andrew.
And this is JJ.
Or evening. Weekend or whatever time it is. We're on the road today.
This is our first on the road podcast, and I'm very excited about this one.
Very excited. We have an author with us today. He wrote a book called The Martian. It's an amazing book. His name is Andy Weir. Thanks for coming into your living room to be on our podcast.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Probably about a month ago, I would say, a month, maybe two, I emailed Andy after reading his book, and I just basically said, I really love your book. I'd really love for you to be on the podcast because The Martian is going to be made into a film. And I was like, this is great. We can tie it together and, you know, to be on our show. And now we're here.
He accidentally replied and said yes, thinking it was something else.
So thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. It's really convenient for me. You guys are just... Came to my house.
Honestly, it's not that much farther than driving anywhere in LA. I think. Yeah,
pretty much.
5 hours to get anywhere.
Pretty much.
This is just closer to Google.
Yeah, we did go to Google today.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome.
Do people, like, I know this has nothing to do with the industry, but do people go to Google and just wander around like tourists? Because I feel like that's what was happening today, but I don't know if...
Well, I don't know, because I've never done that, so I don't know if I've seen people there doing that. I've gone there and had free lunch a few times, because I've got some friends who work there.
Nice.
They can get, you know.
Free lunch, too?
Free bicycles that you have to put back when you're done taking your picture.
Okay, so I got on a bike, and a guy told me to get off of it.
It's magical.
It makes sense. It's a liability.
Your book is fantastic.
Thanks.
Where did you start with the book, by the way?
Well, I was I'm a space dork. I've always been a big fan of manned and unmanned spaceflight, NASA and ESA and the Russian space, everybody's.
Yeah.
And so I was sitting around thinking, how could we do a manned mission to Mars? I wasn't thinking in terms of a book. I was thinking of, okay, how would we actually do a manned mission to Mars? So I was like designing it in my mind, trying to figure out how to get the astronauts there, how to get them back. Any mission plan needs to account for problems and things that can go wrong. And so I'm like, okay, what are the various things that could go wrong when you're on the surface of Mars? And how do you deal with it? How do you make sure the crew doesn't die if this thing breaks?
That's usually a good thing.
Yeah.
For them to die.
Yeah, for them to not die.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, okay, what if this breaks? Okay, well, they'd do this. Well, what if that broke? Well, then they'd do this. Well, what if this happened and that happened and this broke? You know, you start coming up with the multi-tier failure, you know.
Sure.
Yes.
And that's...
This book is good at that. Yeah.
Yes, it is.
And I thought, like, this is starting to make for an interesting story idea, you know, just like a guy who's having all these problems. And so I made an unfortunate protagonist and subjected him to all of it.
Well, he's a lovable character. I love the guy. Is that the correct thing to say?
Yeah.
I mean, you immediately care about him. And the fact that there's humor along with the tragedy makes it so much, I don't know, it's just an easy read.
Yeah. As I was telling JJ when we were driving up, my theory about this whole thing is that because there was so much detail in terms of the science and the math and, you know, everything that went into this, my feeling is that this is actually based on you. You did go to Mars. You did all this stuff, and then you came back and you wrote about it, because that's the only way I can figure it.
Well, I did put a lot of work into trying to make the science as accurate as I could.
Yeah.
Is it kind of like you're building the world first, and then now that you've figured out all of the technical stuff, now how does a story play into that? Or was it kind of as you went along?
Well, it started off with, like, defining the mission. This is how the Mars mission works. This is the equipment he would have. And then here's the thing that goes wrong. And then just kind of work from there and see what happens. Sometimes I'd realize, oh crap, he's in an inescapable situation. I can't come up with any way for him to survive.
Right.
So then I'd just, you know, I could retroactively add a piece of equipment that he can use to save his life earlier into the book.
That's very smart.
That's what we do in television when we've written ourselves into a corner. Oh, there happens to be a pickaxe in the corner of this room.
Wouldn't you know it?
What I really loved about it is that it was first person for the majority of it. Spoilers for everybody that hasn't read. If you haven't read this book, read it and then come back to this.
Yeah.
Because the first person is so great. I mean, I really enjoyed that. And then right when you're like, where are we going to go from here? then you introduce the Earth and how everybody's seeing this. And I was like, oh, that's great.
That's, yeah, I was hooked.
Sorry, I'm gushing. I just really love this book.
Well, thanks.
Yeah.
That's the goal.
Yeah. There were some other questions that we had come up with.
Nope, that was it.
No? Okay.
Have you been to Mars?
I have not.
Right, end of podcast. Well, so we can go back a bit in terms of your background and how you got started and what brought you into this whole Martian world to begin with as a writer.
Well, I guess I've always wanted to be a writer, like my whole life, even when I was a kid reading, you know, Beverly Cleary books, Henry Huggins and his dog, Ribsy.
Yeah.
And I would write little one-paragraph fanfics of those when I was like seven.
Nice.
I mean, and so I've always been a fan of writing. And just, yeah.
Hello? Oh. Yeah.
No, it's just cats going through our stuff.
My cat in the background is destroying their stuff, if you're curious. Listeners.
It's all right.
So I've always been interested in writing. I've also always been a big fan of the space industry and just space in general. My dad is a big space dork, so I kind of grew up indoctrinated with that.
Yeah.
And so when the time came for me to go to college, I mean, I also really liked computers and I liked programming computers. And so it became time for me to, you know, pick a profession. And I decided that, you know, my dream would be to be a writer, but I also like eating regularly and not living in a box under an overpass and, you know, stuff like that. So I decided, well, I'll do software engineering. And I did that for 25 years. Yeah. I just quit my day job about a year ago.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Awesome.
Thank you. Yeah. Just under a year ago. And but up until then I've been programming computers.
Very cool.
What kind of software?
Oh, lots of stuff. Big, long career. I programmed in C, C++, Java, and some JavaScript. Let's see. When I first started, I was working on a word processor for the Mac called Nisus Writer. Uh-huh. That was like one of my first jobs out of college. That was in the mid-90s. And then I worked for AOL. I worked for Blizzard. By the way, I was one of the programmers on Warcraft 2. That's how long ago that was.
That's like my favorite game. This guy's awesome.
Long time ago. It was 20 years ago that came out.
Wow.
95. Yeah. Mm-hmm. 20 years ago. And then, I worked for AOL. I worked for a bunch of startups.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been all over the place.
So did you find that that helped inform your writing in any particular way?
Well, the engineering, not so much. Not the computer programming, although I did use it to calculate the orbital trajectories. The book, I used accurate orbital physics in the book to describe how they get to and from Earth and Mars. I could show that to you guys. I mean, I can't show it to your listeners, but
we want proof.
Yes,
if you want to give us a still or something,
actually, there's a video.
Oh,
so
perfect.
You can see it.
Yeah.
But I did all the orbital dynamics, and I wrote software to do that for me to figure that stuff out.
That's awesome.
When you have a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. You know?
Yeah,
sure.
So,
I
should write a program for this.
Yeah.
Well, we were looking you up on Wiki before I came over and the book and how you said, well, I can tell you, I can pinpoint every day on the in the book, which is kind of phenomenal. I mean, I feel like you wrote the book as with an engineer's mindset.
Yeah, for sure.
Which makes sense. And I was that I think gravitated me towards it even more.
Gravitated. Because of space.
There we go. Zing. Yeah.
Well, the reason I know all the dates is because the orbital dynamics, you have to choose a launch window. You have to say, like, okay, where are Earth and Mars at any given time?
Okay.
Yeah. And so that means you have to pick a date.
Is it the kind of thing where it has to be happening at a certain time of the year? Like, it's got to be March 12th or whatever.
There's a called a cydonic period between Earth and Mars where Mars goes around, Mars's year is about 2 years long. Not exactly, but I think it's like 1.8, 1.9 years. And then Earth's year is one, obviously. And so what the angle is between Earth and Mars is based on where you are in that cydonic cycle.
Okay.
Yeah, so
interesting.
A cydonic cycle is how long it takes for Earth and Mars to return to the same relative position of each other. So if you imagine the Sun, Earth, and Mars lined up, and then how long will it be until the Sun, Earth, and Mars are all lined up again?
Okay.
Right, so you've got Earth goes around like almost twice before that happens, but Mars is moving as well. And,
right.
And so that cydonic period kind of drives when the windows are. It'll be every X, where X is that period.
Right, because you don't want Mars and Earth at the both ends of the
ellipse. It's more complicated than that because it takes so long to get to Mars that, I mean, Mars is a moving target.
Mm-hmm. True, right? Yeah.
So it's not like going from the Earth to the moon, like in the Apollo missions. The moon is orbiting Earth. So it's always, right. I mean, it changes how far away it is because there's an eccentricity to its orbit. But for the most part, it's always just in the same distance from Earth.
Yeah.
Whereas Mars varies wildly.
I feel like you did so much work into making this whole thing seem realistic that it's the kind of thing where NASA would call you and be like, hey, thanks for doing all that, because now we can go and do it.
No,
it's like a how-to guide of how to survive on Mars.
They're orders of magnitude more precise and more accurate than I was. But I have gotten fan mail from astronauts and NASA people. Yeah, yeah, it's pretty cool. On Christmas Eve, two years ago, I think, it wasn't the most recent one. It was the one before, I think. Yeah, they had to do on the International Space Station. They had to do like an emergency EVA spacewalk to go fix a water pump.
Okay.
Outside of the station, and they had to do that on. It was Christmas Eve. It was December 24th.
Oh, I remember this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so
I wasn't there, but I remember.
You weren't on ISS at the time. Okay.
No.
But they had to do this emergency spacewalk to fix it. So everybody in mission control had to come in and be at their stations and prepping for this EVA. And there's a lot of hurry up and wait kind of stuff. And so they're all there, they're all ready, and then they have to wait 6 hours for the EVA. And so all these mission controllers are just kind of sitting around bored.
Yeah.
And so they apparently got to talking to each other about The Martian, which most of them had read.
That's awesome.
And so they sent me email. So they're like, oh, we liked The Martian.
While they're just sitting around waiting.
Sitting around. And so I was like, I got fan mail from mission control. That's probably the coolest thing.
That's really cool.
Yep.
What did they say?
Or is it
classified?
No, it's nothing's classified in NASA. I have the email somewhere, but I don't remember. It was like a long time ago. But basically, they said we liked the book.
That's the best.
I'm heading out there in end of next month.
Is it to Houston?
Yeah,
oh, very cool.
To give a talk and get tours and stuff.
Oh, that's so
cool.
It's
going to be awesome.
Can we come with you?
No.
Most people just lie to us. Yeah. They're like, sure.
Yeah, come on.
Houston's... You go there, I'll find you. You go to the big tree in Houston, and I'll meet you there.
The big tree.
Saturn 1 or what is it?
Saturn 5.
Saturn 5, yeah.
Yeah, outside Johnson Space Center, yeah.
Yeah.
So there must have been a fair amount of research, though, aside from just programming, going into, I mean, how much of this is artistic license? But I'm wondering,
There is some, for sure. I did do a little bit of, like, shortcuts and hand-wavy stuff on physics where it got inconvenient, but I tried to bury it pretty deep. Yeah. So there are two major things in the book that are, like, inaccurate and deliberately inaccurate. Mm-hmm. First off, the sandstorm right at the beginning. In real life, a Martian dust storm, well, the winds really are 150 to 200 kilometers an hour. I mean, they really do go that fast. But Mars's atmosphere is so thin that it's less than 1% the density of Earth's atmosphere. Okay. And so the inertia of the wind that's hitting you is not very much because it's so thin. It's going fast, but it's so thin that like it would feel like a 1 mile an hour breeze on Earth. That's it. It wouldn't damage anything.
Oh.
And so, I mean, I knew that when I wrote it, and I knew I was like breaking the rules, you know, violating physics. But I didn't. I just decided to go with it because I wanted nature to be the initial cause of this man versus nature story, right?
Oh, interesting.
Sure.
Okay.
I had an alternate idea where they're testing the MAV ascent engine or something like that, and it blows up and causes all the problems. And I thought of that, but I was just like, nah, it's just not as cool as a sandstorm. So for the 0.01% of people who know that wouldn't actually happen. They were disappointed, but nobody else knew.
Well, it's a good idea. I mean, it's a great idea to have Mother Nature being the cause of the destruction instead of NASA being the cause of their own destruction.
Right. Yeah. It's events out of their control instead of just like an oversight or stupidity.
It's a PR thing.
And the other place where I was really hand-wavy is, so I just say in like one paragraph somewhere, I say, well, the HAB is radiation shielded. Mm-hmm. I think there's like a throwaway joke. It says like, oh, if it wasn't for the radiation shielding in the HAB, I'd have so much cancer, my cancer would have cancer, right?
Yes.
Because, the sun spews out a lot of radiation. And there's also GCRs, which is basically radiation coming in from deep space. Mm-hmm. We are protected from all of that on Earth by our magnetosphere, which is just the magnetic field of Earth deflects the radiation, and our atmosphere also stops a lot of it. Mars doesn't have a magnetosphere to speak of, and its atmosphere is extremely thin. So if you're on Mars, you're getting subjected to a lot of radiation. Now, that's why I said, like, okay, well, the HAB is radiation shielded.
Yeah.
But
that's my
it's just a gunshot going off.
Ron Swanson.
Safe. Exactly. He gets my jokes, too. Man, this is awesome. Sorry about that.
No worries. The radiation would be an issue, and I just said, like, okay, the HAB is shielded from radiation, but there is no such material that could shield from the radiation and be that thin and flexible. Like, you would need literally, like, something like 15 to 20 centimeters of water or, like, a meter of dirt and rock and sand and stuff like that to so there, that's very hand-wavy. The, HAB canvas just magically stops the radiation. Well, yeah. It wouldn't.
That's good to know.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to go up to Mars. So.
You're going to go after this.
Yeah.
Just make sure you pile up a meter of dirt over your, habitat.
Speaking of dirt and Mars and the book, why potatoes?
Well, I'll tell you why potatoes. So for those of you who haven't read the book, this isn't much of a spoiler. He starts growing potatoes to inside of his pressurized habitat so he'll have food. And the answer is potatoes have the very best calorie yield per, like, crop area of anything by far. So with the limited amount of crop space, you can make more calories with potatoes than you can with anything else.
Very cool.
To
keep them alive. And so I explained
Thanksgiving dinner
why he had a viable potato that he could plant and
I love potatoes, but when he starts talking about eating the raw potatoes, I'd rather die.
Well, he'd cook them in a microwave, but it's still just
potatoes.
Potatoes,
and then he's so excited to eat these meal packs.
Yeah.
But what exactly is a meal pack?
Are we talking about
an MRE or is this a?
Well, they're like like what they eat on the space shuttle or ISS. It's these prefab, prepackaged, dehydrated, meal packs that would be. They'd be designed to make sure that you get a full balanced diet, nutrition, and you don't feel hungry, but at the same time made to be as light as possible because they needed to ship it all to Mars. So they'd want to reduce mass as much as possible.
Right.
Best way you can do that with food is dehydrate it.
Mm-hmm.
They needed enough to last 6 crewmen 31 days, or sols, which is a sol is a Martian day, which is just about 40 minutes longer than an Earth day.
I thought it was longer than that.
It's actually very convenient. Like, it's just a huge coincidence that Mars is almost the same day length.
Yeah.
Anyway, so they'd sent enough food for that, and they'd sent a bunch of extra just in case some of the food supplies had been destroyed or whatever. They had extra.
Right.
So Mark had, I think, about 300 man days of food at the point that he realizes he's stranded. So that's like all the prepackaged food that he has, which gave him enough time to grow potatoes.
Right.
I like the whole, I enjoyed the setup. It's kind of like you can't show a gun in the first act unless you're going to fire in the third when he's talking about, this one I'm going to save for when I survive something that should have killed me.
Yeah,
I wonder what it's going to be because it's coming. And
check
sure
out
enough,
the meal pack.
Yeah. I know, and I remember earlier on you're talking about the worst thing that could happen would be if the rover rolled over, and then I was I hope that doesn't occur.
And the way you set that up, too, I remember vividly listening to it. Like, I was going to a Starbucks and I couldn't get out of the car because I was listening to it as well. And you go into third person and you talk about how Mars was put together and I was like, oh no, where is this going?
how the ramp area formed in Schiaparelli crater or Schiaparelli crater.
Yep.
I've never gotten a firm answer on how that's pronounced.
Did you talk to anybody when you were doing research and all that?
I didn't know
kind of experts or
no, I didn't know anyone in aerospace when I was writing it. Okay. I do now, but I didn't then.
How convenient.
I didn't know I did know a bunch of like scientists,
right?
And so I could run the physics and the chemistry by people, but in terms of like aerospace knowledge and stuff, it was just me and Google.
Oh. Which is across the street.
So. Yes, right. There you go. Yes,
that's very helpful. And you self-published initially.
Yeah.
I have a question actually from one of our listeners that has to do with self-publishing. This is Kelly from Tarzana, California.
Hello, Kelly.
Everyone. She says, we've seen a shift in the way that books are being published and marketed, most notably yours and E.L. James' 50 Shades of Grey, which is basically the same book.
Same book, pretty much.
Do you feel that your voice would have been heard if it weren't for the new phenomena of self-publishing and the internet?
I really don't think it would have. I think she's right. There's been a huge change, and it's awesome. It's great. It's the best time right now to try to become a writer, because up until like a few years ago, there was always like an old boy network between you and the readers. You needed to get a publisher to approve of you. You needed to convince them that this was a saleable idea, that it would make money. Now you can do it on your own without really any financial risk. You can write a book and then put it up for sale. You don't have to pay for it to be printed or anything. There are numerous services, most notably KDP, which is Amazon's Kindle Direct Publishing.
Oh, okay.
Barnes & Noble has one as well, and there's a few others. And you can just go out on your own, and they don't require you to pay them anything. They just get a cut of your sales.
Oh,
so okay. Anybody That's can do it. Anybody can do it. It's great. The only thing you're risking is the actual time that you put into writing the book.
Yeah.
And if you want to be a writer, that's...
Yeah.
You know, that's what what you should be doing.
Yeah.
So what was the writing process? I mean, were you working and then coming home at night and writing, or how was...
Yeah. Yeah. It was just... to give you like a much longer answer than you might have expected.
We got time to fill.
Back when I was in my late 20s, when I was working for America Online in the late 90s-ish, they laid me off along with 800 of my friends when they merged with Netscape. And so that's how long ago it was.
Yeah.
And I was unemployed, but I also had a bunch of money because I had a bunch of stock options that I cashed out and AOL had done really well. So I realized I could go years without having to work and I'd still be financially comfortable. And so I said, like, all right, nice. I'm gonna write a book. That's what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna take my shot at trying to break into the industry. So I wrote a book and then I tried to get it, you know, published, of course. And so I tried to get a literary agent. No literary agent was interested. I tried to get it published. No publisher was interested. It's a standard story. This was not The Martian. This is a previous effort. One of the main problems was that it sucked.
Okay.
So that was one of the main issues with it.
Sometimes an issue, yeah.
That was actually my second book. The first book really sucked. Fortunately, the first book was before the days of the internet, so there's no digital copies out there. That's good. One will ever see it. But anyway, so I figured like, well, after 3 years, I figured, well, okay, I give it a whirl. I tried. Now I don't have to wonder, you know, what might have been.
Sure.
I'm going to go back into software engineering, which I liked. I mean, I like programming computers. It wasn't this, you know, hangdog, oh, woe is me. I was like, okay, well, I'll just do this other profession that I like.
Yeah.
And I decided, well, I'll just write for fun. I'll write short stories and serials and comics and stuff like that for fun. And so, and posting them online because the internet was starting to get more and more popular.
Mm-hmm.
So I started posting things online. I made a comic called Casey and Andy for a really long time. Made another one called Cheshire Crossing. And then and then I made like short stories and the Martian was just a serial that I started writing and posting to my site.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, that's kind of the tale of how I ended up. You asked like, when did I do it? Well, it was my hobby. So I do it nights and weekends and yeah. So that's,
so how did it go from the serial on the internet to a published hardcover book?
Well, I was just serializing it, and I had accumulated readers. Mostly I'd accumulated readers from a previous short story that I'd written called The Egg, and that was really popular online. And so that got a lot of people to my site, and they joined my mailing list and stuff like that. A lot of people ended up getting hooked on The Martian, which was awesome. I had regular readers, and that really helped motivate me. It got me excited. I'm like, oh, yeah, I got people waiting on this. People care, you know?
Yeah.
And it was also really handy because they would check all my math, check all my science and physics, because my readers are dorks, right?
Oh,
like
man.
Me. Like me. I mean, so
So pressure is on.
Awesome, because it was like that helped me make a really accurate book. They'd point out all the errors and I'd go fix them.
Yeah.
It's not like things were set in stone once I posted it.
That's true.
I'm like, I reserve the right to go change anything I want, you know.
Oh, that's nice.
It's almost like having someone proofread your entire book one chapter at a time.
It's like having thousands of people proofread your book. It was great.
Oh, that's such a great idea.
It worked out great. Anyway, so I finished it and I'm like, well, I'm done, on to the next serial. And then, so I started getting email from people saying like, hey, I love your book, but I hate your site. It's, you know, because it's really unprofessionally done. It's just like,
wait, aren't you a programmer?
I'm not a web developer. I'm a software engineer. Yeah.
There's a difference, Andrew.
Yeah. And I didn't care. The site was just a place to dump data.
Yeah.
So people are like, I like your book, but I hate reading it on your website. Can you make an e-reader version? So I'm like, okay. So I made an EPUB version and a Mobi version, figured out how to do that. And I posted them to my site. I'm like, there you go. And then I got email from other people saying like, hey, I love that there's an e-reader version. And of course, I hate reading it on your website. But I'm not very technically savvy, and I don't know how to download a thing from the internet and put it on my e-reader. Can you just put it on Kindle? So I'm like, okay. So I went to Kindle. And it's really easy. You just upload the EPUB or whatever, and they hold on to it for like a day or two, and I think they have a human look at it just to make sure it's not a big book full of goat porn or whatever. and then yeah, don't judge.
True. No.
I'm a fan.
Everybody has their thing.
Everybody's a little bit of goat porn. Somebody look up what Latin for goat is, and then we can get a proper term for what a goatophile is.
Goatus maximus.
Goatus.
Yeah. I don't know.
Goatophile. Anyway, so they check to make sure it's not goat porn, and then they put it up there, and you can set the price to whatever you want, and they get a percentage of it.
Right.
And depending on what percentage they get is what the minimum price you're allowed to set is. So I really just wanted to give it away, but Amazon won't let you do that. They want to make money. They're not just a free data hosting service, right?
Right.
So the minimum price I was allowed to set was 99 cents. So I set the price at 99 cents, and I said, okay, everybody, you can read it for free on my website, or you can download the e-reader version for free from my website, or you can pay Amazon $1 to put it on your Kindle for you. And way more people paid the $1 than downloaded it for free.
Wow.
Which shows you two things. One, Amazon has a huge reach into the readership market.
Right.
And two, people are just, they're willing to pay $1 to avoid technical hassles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it started working its way up the top sellers lists in Amazon, in the Kindle stuff. It got up to like number one in sci-fi, number one in Kindle fiction, stuff like that. Actually, I don't think it got to one on just all Kindle, but it sold really well. And that got the attention of Random House.
Okay.
And so an editor at Random House named Julian Pavia read it. It was recommended to him by a book scout. They have people who just read like self-published books to see if, you know, what's doing well. And it's great for them. They just sit back. It's almost like watching a farm.
Yeah.
It's like they just sit back and go like, what's selling well?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
What's selling well? That's a proven seller. Let's talk to that guy.
Sure.
Anyway, so he decided, oh, okay, we probably want to make a print edition of this. We're going to talk to that guy. But first I want to get the opinion of a colleague of mine. This is Julian talking in my mind. a colleague of mine named David Fugate, who is a literary agent. He said, like, David, read this. I want an external opinion, someone outside of Random House to tell me what he thinks. So David read it, and he said, like, oh, I like it. Then he came to me and said, do you need an agent? And so after 3 years of, like, getting turned down by every agent that I asked, now suddenly I have an agent coming to me.
Just like, happens like that.
And I'm like, yeah. I mean, after I checked him out to make sure he's, like, a real agent, I'm like, yes, I need an agent. He's like, great, Random House wants to publish your book. And I'm like, well, that's nice. And then he turns around to Julian and says, like, so how much are you going to pay us for this?
Yeah. Right?
Which is what Julian expected. Julian was like, he basically said, like, well, this guy's going to need an agent because we're going to make him offer. So it's just ethics, you know.
Sure.
And then so, yeah, they worked out a deal. And around the same time, so there was this spike in interest in The Martian just right all at that time. Around the same time, 20th Century Fox came asking about the movie rights. And so those negotiations are going on at the same time.
Oh.
And then so both deals were made in the same week. So that was like they were 4 days apart.
Had a good week.
That was a stressful week.
Did you have a few old fashions?
I did. I drank to I I did everything. I was about as stressed as I've ever been. I'm like, oh, I see. All my dreams are maybe going to come true. Let's find out.
Yeah.
Yep. And so all that worked out. The movie, at the time, it was just the movie option. Now, for people who, I'm sure you guys know, but maybe your listeners don't, on how the difference between movie options and movie rights.
Yeah.
Yep.
What they do is they say, you work out a deal with the studio. In my case, it was like 30 pages long, the contract for the movie rights. They don't mess around.
No.
And you work out the whole rights purchase deal in advance, but they don't actually activate it. You don't actually, they don't actually buy the rights from you. What they do is they're buying the option from you, which means they can activate that contract at any time within a certain time limit. And if they if they do, then they have the rights. Also, they are the only people who are allowed to buy the rights at that point.
Right.
Oh, so they give you. So they're going into like exclusivity.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And so what happens is they have.
I can't speak
the rights. The rights themselves to buy it. The buy the rights costs them a big pile of money.
Right.
To secure the option, they give you a little pile of money. They say like, here's some money so that we are the only people who can buy the rights. And if we choose to activate it, then we'll give you this big pile of money.
Gotcha.
And as a rule, they only actually buy the rights the day they start filming, because they option movies like all the time. I mean, they'll option like hundreds of movies for every one, hundreds of stories for every actual movie they make.
Right.
So when at the moment you get optioned, you still have less than a 1% chance of that actually being made into a movie.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense because budgeting and what
so they're just grabbing exclusivity for a while.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And then well, it's kind of cool for you too as a writer. If they don't activate the contract within a certain time, then it expires and the rights come back to you.
Right.
So a lot of writers who have like popular books that just haven't quite been made into movies yet, they just sell the rights over and over again. They just sell that option.
Yeah.
And the small, quote unquote, small amount of money is tens of thousands of dollars. So they'll just, if you're a writer and you have like 20 or 25 books under your belt and studios are interested in like 10 of them, and they're just like kind of cycling through that.
Yeah.
So you can
make a living.
You can live off of that. Yeah,
absolutely.
Without them ever taking it seriously as a film.
Yeah.
But of course, in the case of The Martian, they did make the film. Yeah. They are making it.
And of all people that could be making your movie is Ridley Scott.
Ridley Scott, I know. Yeah. It's like so a awesome fantasy. It's like
we're living in your world, man.
Yeah, I know. I'm just like kicking back going like, well, if I'm going to have a fantasy about this, what would I want? Well, I'd want the movie to be made into a big budget blockbuster. I'd want like one of the greatest directors of all time to direct it. I'm going to want a big star to play Watney, right?
Yeah.
You know, like Matt Damon. And I'm going to want all of the other roles, no matter how small, to be filled by big name actors.
Seriously, the cast on this movie is amazing.
It really is.
If Kate Mara is listening right now, please email me.
Yeah, Kate has to email JJ now.
Yeah.
She'll be Johansson.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, which is awesome.
Yeah.
Now we were talking about this before we came over. The person that discovers Mark, who is playing
Mindy Park is the
Mindy
character's
Park
name.
Right.
Who is Mindy Park playing?
Mackenzie Davis.
Okay.
So Halt and Catch Fire, have you seen that?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she's in that.
That's awesome.
That's her. She's playing Mindy
Park. Then Kristen Wiig is playing the PR.
Annie Montrose, the PR. Yeah.
Yes.
That's perfect casting.
Absolutely.
Interested to see what she does with that.
Oh, I'm sure she'll kick ass.
Yeah.
I heard that they're done filming. Like
right.
They've finished all the filming.
Yeah.
And I've heard that that the NASA scenes are just awesome.
Oh, really?
That everybody was really, really happy with how the NASA stuff came out.
Yeah.
That's very cool. And they shot over in Budapest, correct?
Yeah, they did all the set and studio work was in Budapest, and also the on location stuff. So when they're in big lobbies and stuff like that, where buildings around Budapest playing the part of NASA buildings.
Tax credits are so weird.
Yep. Absolutely.
What looks like Houston? I don't know, Budapest.
Well, it's not like they're going to show the skyline.
Yeah.
So you got this Gothic architecture and stuff like that. Houston.
Wait a minute.
But all the extras are speaking Turkish or something.
Or Hungarian, probably.
Whatever.
And then they did the on location, quote unquote, location shots in Jordan, Wadi Rum, Jordan,
which is
a desert that looks very much like Mars. If you just do a Google image search of Wadi Rum, Jordan, you're like, wow, that's Mars.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I saw the photo of Matt Damon with Was it with his assistant?
His assistant, Colin, who lost a Super Bowl bet to him.
Right.
And so now Colin is a big Seahawks fan, and Matt Damon is a big Patriots fan. And so they're like, oh, we got to have a bet. Yeah. And so Colin now has to wear a Patriots jersey every day for a year, although he doesn't have to wear it all day.
That's awful.
He just has to wear it like once a day for a year. You can put it on, take a picture, take it off.
Oh, that's great.
And they're traveling around the world for his next several movies. So But anyway, so somebody, one of them, I don't know who did it. I think Colin took the picture. I'm not sure. But one of them took a picture of them standing next to each other and like, in Patriots jersey. And Damon is in costume as Mark Watney. And he's wearing a shirt. And on the shirt has a name placard on it that says Mark Watney. And in the background, you can see the rover. So it's really cool. And so I see this because I search the web pretty much every day to see if there's any new images or anything interesting like that. And I found this image. It's been around since like March 5th. It's
been that's what
out
I heard.
In the internet. It's been around for a while. And then I was like, oh, that's cool. I'll post it to Facebook. So then all of a sudden, then all the other outlets picked it up from my Facebook. They're like, oh, Andy Weir just posted this. Andy Weir just posted it. And I'm like, this makes it look like I'm the source of this image.
Yeah.
And I wasn't. And I was like, oh my God, is the studio going to come tear me a new one because I'm like leaking stuff? And I'm like, I swear, I did not. I wasn't there. I swear.
I was not the person who caused this image to be on the internet.
I just found it online and reposted it. Yeah. But it's great. It's awesome.
Yeah. Well, the fact that there's buzz about the movie before it comes out and just... Yeah.
I'm really looking forward to a trailer. Yeah. I don't know when. So my job on the movie is mostly was just to cash the check. I mean, that's pretty much my job.
Not a bad gig.
It's a good gig. But they chose to involve me. They didn't have to involve me in anything. Mm-hmm. Once they buy the rights, they can just not speak to me ever again if they wanted.
Sure.
They chose to involve me in a few things. So I was involved in the screenplay a little bit. They sent it to me for comments, and we talked a lot. The screenplay was written by Drew Goddard, who directed Cabin in the Woods. He wrote Cloverfield, a bunch of episodes of Lost, and Buffy the Vampire Slayer. He's a very good writer. And he loved the book, and he wrote a great screenplay, and I gave feedback, and he made some changes based on my feedback and ignored other, whatever. And so that people always ask, oh, what's your involvement in the movie? And that's all I did pretty much for that, and answered questions. It was this kind of funny game of like telephone where it's like, Ridley Scott would have a question about something like science stuff or some technical question.
Right.
Sure. So he'd have his assistant ask Drew Goddard, who would in turn ask me.
Yeah.
And then it would work its way backwards up the line to Ridley Scott. So I've never met or spoken to anyone involved in the thing except for Drew Goddard and for the producer, Aditya Sood.
Okay.
And so, although I expect to meet, hopefully expect to meet the stars at the premiere.
That would be cool.
It's in my contract. I get to go to the premiere.
Oh, so that's awesome.
Nice.
Is it going to be in L.A.?
I don't know. They haven't decided.
It's going to be in Budapest.
It might. Mm. I don't know. That's a marketing decision, right?
Sure.
So they can decide for them. They can. It's kind of part of the publicity of the movie is where they choose to do the premiere.
Yeah.
And so they might say like, oh, we'll do it in Houston, right?
Right.
Because NASA. Or
that's
they
true.
Might
right.
say we'll do it in L.A. Or they might go, thanks to the people of Budapest, we'll do that. I have no idea.
Acidalia Planitia, perhaps.
That might be a bit rough to get people there.
It's costly.
It's going to take a couple months.
Yeah.
Would you, another listener was asking, his name is Wally, and he lives in Los Angeles. He was wondering if you were thinking about the movie as you were writing the book. Not that movie rights were a thing at that point, but was that in your mind at some point?
I think every writer who's writing imagines their story as a movie, right? I think everybody like daydreams about that. Although I wasn't writing it with the intention of it being a movie. I was writing it with the intention of it being a serial and also just directed toward my nerdy readers, which is why it's so deeply technical, right? And when I was first starting it, I thought, oh, maybe this is just a story that'll go on indefinitely. It'll be like, follow the adventures of Mark Watney on Mars. Tune in next week, But
it's going to be on the radio.
Yeah, right, basically. But and then I realized, okay, I'm starting to see that there's an arc here, a story arc, and it's developing, and it's going to have an end. And if I were to drag it out, then it would get stupid.
Yeah.
So then I'm like, okay, fine, it's a book.
Yeah.
But I never really, I was never like, oh, I've got to write this such that it would make a good movie.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is like, one of the complaints I see, you know, in the bad reviews is people are like, well, it was very cyclical. There's like problem, solution, problem, solution, problem, solution, right?
Sure.
And that's definitely true. That's valid criticism. And the reason for that is because it's a serial.
Yeah.
Problem, right. Solution, problem, yeah. Solution. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, I guess, because is every chapter part of the serial, or is it?
I posted them a chapter at a time.
Okay.
Yeah. So each one of those chapters was a discrete post.
I gotcha.
Although I would often go back and edit. Like, I'd be like, so I'd post, I'd say like, okay, everybody, here's chapter 6 of The Martian. And by the way, I did heavy edits to chapter 4.
You know, it's kind of cool, though. It's very, you know, you're talking so back awesome, and forth though. With the readers. And
it was great.
Of,
I wish I could do that with my current book, but I can't because I've sold the rights already. Like I'm working on my next book for Random House, and so they don't want me to give it away for free.
Sure,
that makes sense,
which is perfectly reasonable. It means I can't have my beta reader program kind of thing.
How does that work exactly for? So your second book, do they give you, because like, I've heard of advances people get?
Yeah.
Like, how does that work exactly?
So the way a book deal works in general is. They, for whatever reason, you convince them to give you money for a book, right?
Sure.
You convince them to publish your book. first, get a book deal. Okay.
Nice.
And then what they'll do is, yes, then they'll give you, they'll agree on an advance. An advance is just a pile of money that they're going to give you. And the idea is usually writers need something to live on while they're writing the book, right? So they're giving you an advance on presumed royalties later. And they will give you a chunk of the advance immediately upon signing the deal. They'll give you another chunk when you deliver the first completed draft. They'll give you another chunk when it appears on shelves. And then they'll give you the last chunk 6 months later. That last chunk 6 months later thing is to keep you behaving during the marketing aspect of the book.
Oh. Like,
you know, to keep you
out and do a bunch of goat porn.
Right. Yes. Don't go out and do just the normal amount of goat porn. But
is that so it then? It's done at that point?
Well, that's an advance. So that's money that's guaranteed.
Got it.
Okay. And then also you'll get royalties, which you get a percentage of every single book sale, and it's based on the pre-tax cover price of the book.
Okay.
And so for every copy of The Martian that gets sold, I get a percentage of the pre-tax price based on what type it is. So I get a larger percentage of hardback sales than I do of like paperback. I get an even smaller percent for ebook sales. So that's also money that the author gets. Now, the advance is not a bonus, it's an advance. So the first thing that has to happen with your royalties is your royalties go to pay off that advance. They work toward paying off the advance, and it's called earning out. You earn out your advance means that your royalties have now equaled or exceeded your advance. And that's when you start getting royalty checks. So the advance is literally an advance.
So it's kind of like credit.
It is, except you will never have to pay it back.
Right.
So if
right.
they give you an advance and your book is a bomb and it doesn't ever sell it, you don't owe them any money back.
Right.
So that's yours forever. So they are taking a risk by giving you an advance.
But contractually, it's also like you're going to give us what you've agreed to give us.
Yes. Yeah. If you don't give them a book at all, then of course they can sue you for it. Or, you know, if you give them just a bunch of goat porn and if it's not a book that they knew was going to be goat porn.
Yeah.
Right.
50 Shades of Bae.
Oh my God. I can't top that.
No, no, you can't. So, so you have one last question.
We had one last question. This is from Brett on Reddit. And he uses a word that, I'll be honest with you, I don't know how to pronounce.
Okay.
Because I'm a TV writer, and we don't use words that the actors can't pronounce, so I never learned them. It's that word.
Perchlorate.
Okay. Perchlorate?
Perchlorate.
Perchlorate.
Yeah,
okay.
So it's probably about the soil conditions.
It is. He says, with the recent discovery of heavy concentrations of perchlorate on Mars, basically making the farming of raw Martian dirt impossible, how do you think you might have developed the story differently if you started now? Would there have just been a different buildup of processing the soil before using it?
Yeah, I would have. I don't know how to get rid of the perchlorate. I don't know how to process the soil, but I would have done a bunch of research on it, figured out how to do it, and then made sure one way or another Mark had some ghetto way of making that happen. He'd be like, so it would have been cool. It's frustrating to me because when, you know, there's been a bunch of new information about Mars since I wrote the book.
Yeah.
And mostly due to curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
And it's too bad because a bunch of this stuff is actually really cool, and I could have worked it into the mm-hmm. book. Like, I would have figured out how do you make Martian soil suitable for growing crops, and I would have, like, had that be yet another problem that he had to solve, and it would have been great.
Yeah.
And, of course, I could, if it's like, oh, no, you need to have this chemical, or you need to do that, or you need to have that, well, I'd make sure that he had it. For
right.
one way or another, I'd come up with a plausible way that he'd have it.
Yeah.
One thing that, what was it? Somebody did all the math on when he's reducing hydrazine. So mm-hmm. he takes the fuel of the descent vehicle, which he still has. He takes some fuel and then does a chemical reaction with it to separate out the hydrogen.
Mm-hmm.
And then he burns the hydrogen with oxygen to make water, which is what he needed.
Right.
That doesn't go well.
Yeah.
But anyway, I got email from a chemist, and he was like, You say in the book all the following information is available within the book about what he did.
Mm-hmm.
You told us how much hydrazine he reduced. You told us how long it took him to do it. You told us the interior volume of the HAB,
mm-hmm.
and you told us the atmospheric pressure and temperature and makeup of the air inside the HAB, right? And he goes, like, from all that, I can calculate the energy released by the by the chemical reaction he did, and how much the HAB would heat up, because we know the volume of the HAB and its heat capacitance and everything like that. And he's like, the interior side of the HAB would have heated up like 400 degrees centigrade.
Like, so it would have fried him.
It would have absolutely yeah. killed him, right?
Yeah.
And I'm like, I wish I'd known that,
yeah.
because it's something that I could come up with all sorts of ways for him to solve. I could be sure. like, well, for starters, he could just take longer and let the heat dissipate. It's mm-hmm. not hard to get rid of heat on Mars. The mm-hmm. problem is actually not freezing to death.
Yeah.
And then he could have just brought big rocks in, which are just giant heat sinks. If you think about it, they're freezing yeah. cold outside. You bring them in.
Right.
So, yeah. and I was like, oh man, I wish I'd known. Another cool thing. The Curiosity probe, it's by Mount Sharp, which is very far away from all the fictional locations in the, well, they're real locations, but the real locations mentioned in the book where mm-hmm. Mark is and stuff like that. But when they had narrowed it down to four landing sites, one of them was Marth Vallis,
okay.
which is Mark drives through that valley.
Yeah.
right? And I was like, oh, God, are they really going to land it right there?
Yeah.
And then people are going to say, like, why didn't he go to Curiosity? And you basically yeah. had to drive over Curiosity. Up, why didn't you do that? It's like, shut up, because it wasn't there.
yeah.
Awesome. So what was the other one where he says he's like, it was like 300 kilometers or something
from Opportunity.
It? And so that was...
That's real. Yeah.
That's real.
That's where it is.
That would have been an amazing opportunity.
Ah, yes. Well, he mentioned that. He said, I have an opportunity. And by opportunity, I mean opportunity.
Oh, did I? Sometimes I steal material
from people. That's fine. Well, you're a TV writer, you know.
He knows. He knows. The jig is up.
Yeah, well, your listeners can't see it, but there's a poster on my wall that was taken by Opportunity, that
oh.
picture
oh.
was taken. Yeah.
We're going to have to take a picture. I think that might be the picture of the
thing.
For our post.
Yeah.
I think that would be cool.
It's very nice. It's very red.
It's Mars.
Yeah.
then now,
or Budapest.
Another thing that we were talking about is, and I don't know if it was actually stipulated in the book, but is this supposed to take place in present day or shortly into the future?
It's shortly into the future. In fact, okay. that's fun too, because like I said, like I know exactly the dates that it takes place because I yeah. had to pick a launch window,
mm-hmm.
and I made it take place slightly in the future, and an alert and scientifically minded reader was able to back calculate from information in the book the exact launch
that
date.
That is amazing.
And he was correct.
Spare time.
Yeah.
And he was correct to the day. Yeah. And so I can go ahead and tell you it takes place. So Sol 6, the beginning of the book is, I think, November 12th, 2035.
Okay.
Oh, cool. That's shortly after there's supposed to be a comet that comes by Earth around that time, too. It's supposed to take us all out.
Oh, so okay. Well, that's good news.
But I got plans for...
yeah, no, but it's
I don't know.
So he used... the reader used the information... Let's see. It was first off, he knew that, like, Sol 16 was Thanksgiving
mm-hmm.
of that year.
Oh, right.
And so he was able to do right. that. He knew the transmission times... Because it mentioned the transmission times between mm-hmm. Earth and Mars and Earth
right.
and Hermes and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So And he was able to.
Oh, wow.
And so he back calculated from that.
Physicist, man.
2035.
2035, so about 20 years from now.
I don't listen to a ton of science fiction or read a ton of science fiction, admittedly. So one of the things I really enjoyed about this book was that it felt as crazy as the situations were, it felt very grounded to me, like what was happening and what's going on Earth. And it wasn't a lot of, I mean, again, I'm not a science guy, so it could have all been complete BS and I would have not known the difference, but you know.
There's a little bit of BS, but for the most part, I did try to make everything. So all the tech in the book really exists. Like all that stuff really exists.
That's awesome.
There really are ion engines that have been used on spacecraft.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, all that stuff really exists, although not as efficient or effective as
it's
depicted.
Right.
They're like next generation of them, but yeah.
Yeah. Is there an image from your book that you really hope that they do how you imagined it? Like,
A bunch of stuff.
Like there's a shot that we were in particular where the canopy flaps and you see something.
When he's taken off at the end there.
Yeah.
The tarp ripping.
Not to give anything away.
Yeah. We said spoilers.
We did. Then I'm going to just say. Yeah.
Well, so unfortunately, I know you got questions, but I can't really talk about the screenplay.
Oh,
you
know, gotcha. That makes sense.
So I don't have any apprehensions because, I've seen it.
You already know what's going to happen.
Have you seen stills and things from... any of the equipment or the things that you wrote about that are...
No, I could. So they keep that in a tight cordon, right? They have better... So I've worked for the U.S. government, right? And I used to work on... I used to have an SRD research clearance, which is like secret data availability. And now I'm working in the movie industry, and the movie industry has better security. Like,
doesn't surprise me.
So they don't let data outside of a... certain cordon. So if I was willing to go down to LA and go to Fox, their like headquarters, then I could look at that stuff.
Okay.
Like, I could watch dailies and could watch stuff like that. But that's kind of far away.
Well, we don't and live also, too I far from the yeah, studio.
You can stay at our place.
Yeah. Well, thanks.
We know people at Fox.
We know people. So do I.
But that's true.
But I haven't done that. Mm-hmm. I might when I go down in probably heading down there. Well, I know I'm going to be down in Southern California in May, so I might. I might stop by. It depends on whether or not the producer that I know is in town or what.
Yeah.
He's currently working on Deadpool.
Oh.
Oh, very cool.
So nice.
That's going to be fun.
Yeah.
You're mingling with some good people.
Yeah, yeah.
Us.
Yeah, you. You. Yeah.
Those people.
Those other people that aren't you.
Yeah.
One of the things that our listeners, our demographic is really geared at people that are trying to get into the industry. Yeah. And
you're talking about film or
film TV, entertainment, really. I know that writing a book is slightly different than doing film and television, although it's worked out nicely for you in the film aspect.
Great, yeah.
But you made that switch from kind of a day job to what you really wanted to be doing or passionate about. Is there any kind of advice that you can give to people who maybe are facing that same struggle?
So my situation was kind of unique because I made the book without doing any personal risk, right? I just kind of made it my own, and then it was successful. I didn't quit my day job until I was sure that I was financially secure from money from the Martian.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So I did not take any risks at all. I'm very risk averse though. Mm-hmm. So I don't like taking risks with money. I'm not much of a gambler. I don't like investing in stocks and stuff like that. I'm all about like super safe, slow growth. So that's just, I guess it has a lot to do with your personality type, but I would definitely not gamble your financial future on a presumption that you'll be able to break into writing. It's it's a very difficult world to get into, as I'm sure you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Andrew is a writer's assistant for a show on ABC Family called Stitchers.
Which is a science fiction-y type of show.
And I don't know exactly where I was going with it.
I don't know either.
I think I maybe had too much old fashioned. I don't know. But
I'll be driving us.
But no, it's taken you a long time to get to where you are in the writing profession. And as a writer's writing profession. Yes, I have been drinking.
Profession.
I'm an amateur bartender, and I made him a drink, by the way.
He's amazing.
He dropped some tablet of some kind in there. And
I'm glad you don't drink, Andrew.
Yes. Would you like another roofie colada?
I think I'll pass. I think that is one thing that a lot of people don't understand is they don't understand that if you come to LA or you come to Chicago that you want to be a writer, that it's going to happen overnight. Yeah. It's going to take a while.
You got to work your way in.
Yeah.
Did you, I mean, I know how we work in TV writing and kind of it's, even if you're just one person writing, you know, you're doing outlines and kind of what they call a vomit draft. What's your process in terms of writing a book? Did you outline everything or did you just kind of go into it?
I just went into it. They say there are plotters and pantsers, right?
Okay.
You either plot everything out or you go by the seat of your pants. And I'm definitely a pantser. Nice. I had the, you know, I like to set up the scenario, and then I knew for The Martian, and I know for my next book, what the climax would be,
mm-hmm.
right? But how to get there, I was just, well, let's see, and just kind of follow along, see what happens.
Yeah.
Which carries with it, the upside of doing it this way is you get a really organic story. Like, it makes sense. Each yeah. thing that happens flows from the previous thing that happens. It doesn't seem like you're rigidly trying to glue unrelated things together. The downside is you'll end up spending a bunch of time and effort working on an offshoot that turns out to be sort of a dead end.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you're like, well, that whole plot is not interesting. It's got to go.
Yeah.
And I've got to tear it out, which means I've got to kind of glue all the scenes together around it that it was, you know, being decompression time for, et cetera. It's just like, it can be a real pain when things go awry, but
yeah.
But that's how I like to do it.
It's kind of fun because you're finding out what's happening in the story.
Yeah.
Almost the same way that the readers are.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's kind of fun to surprise yourself. Oh, that's interesting.
Oh yeah. No, this makes
I'm
sense.
I'm smart. Where does what happens to Mark Watney after the book ends?
Yeah. I never really defined that. I mean, it's kind
I was
of
pissed.
Like,
I was like, it's over.
It's over. Yeah.
I'm so depressed now.
It definitely come. It was a surprise.
Well, you know. Probably noticed there weren't any pages.
Well, I was actually listening
oh, you're in
to
the audiobook. Oh,
yeah, yeah, I did too, but so I had the status over. Bar, so yeah. I knew where it was.
I just didn't pay attention to that. And I was like, oh, this is awesome. And then, yeah.
The end.
Then it was over.
Well, yeah, and I get a lot of crap for that too, but I don't like it when the ending of a story, like, takes too long. Once
mm-hmm.
when the story is over, end it. And I would rather have people. I would rather have people at the end of a book think, "Damn, I wish there were more of this." Than,
"Oh, absolutely.
Damn, that dragged on at the end."
Yep. Yep.
You know, you leave them wanting more.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes people ask me about a sequel and I'm like, how the hell would I sequel this?
He goes back.
I'm like, what? Can you believe this guy's luck?
Yeah.
Another mission, another failure. Oh my God. Just this guy can't get a break.
That or it's like a total 180. He goes back to Chicago. He moves in with his parents.
Yes.
Like they just hang out and play canasta.
They hang out. Yeah. Well, I mean, there are lots of options. It's like, okay, he goes on some mission so some obvious options that all have problems. Like number one, I didn't actually cover the time spent getting back to Earth from Mars.
Right.
It just ends with them in Mars orbit.
Yeah.
It's like, well, Hermes has been like damaged and it's been like, you know, it's way past its maintenance times and mm-hmm. stuff like that. So they could have adventures and problems on the way back. But that would just seem really derivative, right? It would mm-hmm. just seem like, oh, more of the same.
Yeah.
And this time, instead of being, oh, he's on Mars, he's just kind of in space. It's less interesting, right? And then the other thing is like, okay, it's after he's safely back on Earth and stuff like that, but somebody's in trouble in space and he's now in mission control, right? He's like one of the guys on the ground trying to solve the problem. But again, then you have like, oh, it's that main character I loved watching do all these MacGyvery things.
Right.
And now he's like a secondary character. I don't know. I've never come up with a good idea for a sequel.
Yeah, because if he was on mission control and he's telling them, okay, now this is what you need to do now.
Yeah.
This way, you know, that's not as exciting as him coming up with it on its own.
I mean, do you think he just kind of goes home and gets laid a lot and, you know?
One hopes so. Oh, well, yeah. I've got a lot of people email, a surprisingly large number of people saying that he should end up with Mindy Park.
Yeah.
Really?
The SatCon person who noticed him. Like, for some people are like, oh, he should end up with Mindy. They should date. And I was like, wow, you're shipping The Martian. And I'm like, I never even remotely thought about that. But, and I was like, you do realize, so now I have a standard answer to that. I'm like, you realize if that happened, their name as a couple would be Mark and Mindy.
Oh gosh, that's awesome. one last question that I have.
Mm-hmm.
Do you prefer writing in first person or third person?
I prefer first person. It has it carries with it some baggage, though, because mm-hmm. you have to stay wherever that guy is. Mm-hmm. Third person is nice because you can float around. My next book is third person. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I loved the back and forth and just kind of finding out what was going on Earth and what was, and the CNN, the Mark Watney report and all that stuff. And I think my favorite, I love Mark a lot. I was a big fan of Venkat Kapoor.
Yeah, he's the guy. He's you know, to get all literary, he's the deuteragonist.
Okay.
Deuteragonist, yes. His deuteragonist is the second most important character who is positive. Like the mm-hmm. second mm-hmm. the second most important protagonist.
Yeah.
So like Robin of Batman and okay. Robin is right. a deuteragonist, or you know, stuff like that.
I laughed so hard at the, what was the line? I'm going to buy you and your whole team autographed Star Trek memorabilia.
He's like, I prefer Star Trek or Star Wars or whatever. Yeah. Prefers the other one.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for being on the show. Thank you for opening your home to us.
Yeah,
and
sure.
And making opening, me drink and getting bar, me yeah. drunk. You know, I appreciate it.
Can you say anything about your next book, or just that it's in the works? Or
yeah, I mean, it's in the works now. It should be out in early 2016. It's tentatively titled Zhek, Z-H-E-K. It's a more traditional science fiction. It's not the rigidly technically accurate style like mm-hmm. The Martian is. It's got aliens and faster than light travel and telepaths and stuff like that.
Awesome. So when does that movie come out, and can I direct it?
I don't think, it's maybe an eat my words thing. I don't think Zhek would make a good movie. I think it would make a great TV show, but I don't think it would make it.
Hey, there's a lot of money in TV.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I love TV. I think it's like just the best storytelling medium. It's just like it's infinite canvas. You know, it's like when you're into a TV show and you love it, you're like, oh, I've got, you know, 87 hours of content to enjoy now. And the writers can just go like, today we're going to spend an entire episode on the detailed backstory of this minor character. And just the whole world gets really rich. Like Lost did that a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Although they did a lot of like making random crap up as they went along, which kind of made the show suffer.
They literally
They did, yeah.
Hopefully you're not listening to that, Drew.
what's your favorite television show right now?
I watch a lot of TV.
Good, you're keeping us employed.
Yes, I am for sure. Well, I really like House of Cards.
Yep. Excellent.
I think that's just great writing. I liked it. They just had their season finale, How to Get Away with Murder.
Mm-hmm.
I think that one's really good. What are some of the other ones that I always make sure to watch? Shoot. I actually like Madam Secretary. I don't know if it's that popular, but I like it.
Yeah.
I guess I like things about the corridors of power.
Okay.
You know, like, you know, so it's like, oh, I like this show about the president and this other show about the Secretary of State.
Yeah.
And, yeah. Let's see. I could swear there's, I guess Community's coming back.
Yep.
Yep.
On Hulu, right?
Yeah, on Yahoo.
Yahoo. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'll definitely watch that.
Yeah.
Yeah. What else? Shoot. I mean, I could tell you like all sorts of TV shows that are done. So probably one of my favorite shows is Doctor Who.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I've literally seen every episode of Doctor Who that still exists.
Mm-hmm.
Like they've lost 100 episodes or so, but big fan of that. I'm a Star Trek geek as well. Mm-hmm. I've seen all of the Star Treks of all the types.
Yeah.
Did you like Enterprise?
I did. And
Deep Space Nine? Did you like
I thought DS9 was okay.
Yeah.
A lot of people really didn't like Enterprise, but I thought it was great.
Yeah. I have a few friends that worked on it.
It's my second favorite after Classic.
Oh, very cool.
And Classic's my favorite because that's what I grew up watching.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
So that's, you know.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Sentimental.
I was talking to one of my friends that was, he worked on Deep Space Nine for like the last 2 weeks of it, and they took him to the rap party, and they have a, he has a mug that's says Quartz Bar on it.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
I liked DS9. I thought that was good too.
Yeah.
So I didn't really care too much for Voyager.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I watched it all, so yeah. I liked it enough to watch it all.
Sure.
But
sure.
Yeah.
Sometimes you feel like you just owe it to yourself to.
Well, it's a canon that you know that you like, and hopefully they, you know, go through and go, you know.
It's like buying an album for a band that you don't, you love the band and you don't like the album that much, but you have to finish the whole thing.
If anybody wants to, you have a website, right?
Yeah.
AndyWeir.com.
A crappy website, apparently.
I have a crappy website, and
That's how I got a hold of you.
The easiest way, I answer all fan mail.
Yeah.
Or all mail. Yeah.
Obviously, that's why we're here.
Yeah.
The best way to get to my website is just Google me.
Yeah.
There's also my kind of more professional looking one. It's andyweirauthor.com. And that one's Random House manages that one. And it's all about The Martian, really.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
So the book is out now. You can buy it.
Yes,
in all kinds of different places.
And all kinds of languages, too, if you want.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's in about 30 languages.
The guy that read it, by the way, was fantastic. He did a great job.
R.C. Bray, his name.
Yeah.
Bob Bray, but his official name when he's, being credited is R.C. Bray.
Right.
He did a great job.
Did he also do The Egg as well?
He did a reading of The Egg as well.
Yeah. He was great.
He's awesome.
I miss him.
He narrated like a bajillion things.
Oh, really?
Just look him up and you can...
Not as good as The Martian, though. I looked at the list. I was like, this guy's voice is awesome. He is Mark Watney to me.
So. Yeah, that's what a lot of people say. Yeah.
And the movie comes out, is it November 15th?
25th.
25th.
Yeah, no, it's the day before Thanksgiving.
Okay.
Wednesday.
Oh, yeah. That's fitting. They're very fitting.
Yeah.
So November 25th, 2035, the movie comes out. Be sure and see it if you're alive.
It's true.
Yeah. We're looking forward to it. It's going to be exciting.
Yeah. If you guys have any other questions for future guests, also if you have questions for us in general, or questions for Andy, we can always forward them on.
Yeah.
You can call us at 267-225-CHAT.
Send us your horror stories because we're still putting that segment together.
Yep. At earlycalltime@gmail.com. And is there anything else?
I don't know. We're on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and Friendster.
All Friendster?
We're not on Friendster.
No.
MySpace.
Yeah. No.
CompuServe.
Netscape brought back so many memories.
I know. I just remember the little spinning planet in the corner and the star going. I don't even remember exactly what the logo was, but it took forever, so I stared at it a lot.
Yep.
Dial up.
until next week.
Yeah. Listen to the outro.
And that's a wrap. Didn't get your fill at Craft Services and you want more? Check out earlycalltime.com for more podcasts and information pertaining to the ever-growing entertainment industry. And remember to tell your friends about us via Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.